Well, hello, hello, and welcome to episode 8 of Launch and Learn. In this podcast, we talk to entrepreneurs about their experiences in starting and launching startups. This podcast is hosted by Matthias Dickerhof and Alexander Thompson. Today, we have Thomas Sabat on as a guest, who is the COO of Kraken. Kraken is an open source distributed logical database to organize large networks of data. Kraken provides tools for developers to build complex systems in areas such as drug discovery, self-driving cars, and many more. Thomas will talk about his entrepreneurial journey from selling club tickets right out of university to building an open source community at Kraken. Cool. Thanks a lot for coming on Launch and Learn. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me. Are we live already, by the way? Or
yeah, we're recording.
We're going. I see. Good.
I chose the perfect time when you were about to take a coffee slurk, you know?
Yes. I thought I should top up a little bit. No, thank you. Thank you, Alex, for asking me. And I think I mentioned it before, but last time we met was in Tokyo three and a half years ago. So now you're in Zurich, I'm in London. And Matthias, you're in Canada. So you know, all over the place.
That's true. It is very international. So in the UK, I guess it's a bit late afternoon. What did you eat for lunch today?
I ordered a lamb shack from this restaurant Pesantissimo in Primrose Hill. It's a great deal, £9, and some profiteroles. I've got one left here actually. I haven't eaten it yet. I'll show it to you. But the viewers, listeners can't see it, but it's got a lot of chocolate mousse on it. And but I had very little time to eat because I had back-to-back meetings and so I had to finish it quite quickly. But yeah, it was quite nice.
Very nice. Chocolate mousse doesn't sound very healthy, to be honest, but
I know.
It gets the sugar going, so that's good. It does. Thomas, you have had quite an entrepreneurial journey, and as well as what you're doing now. How did that sort of all start? You know, did you have certain inclinations as a child that sort of sparked that, I don't know, entrepreneurial spirit of yours?
So I never consider myself, I still don't consider myself an entrepreneur at all. I just like to do things. And I think, but the thing is that you got to be obsessive about a problem. You have to live it. You have to breathe and live a specific something you want to do with your life. And it just so happens that entrepreneurship is a really good way of expressing that, because obsessive people can be really difficult to work with within a certain team. And so going the entrepreneurial route is a good way of doing that. Now there's other ways of doing that as well, whether that's within other companies and in entrepreneurship as well. So for me, it's just, I think, and I'm still, you know, learning about myself. I can't say that I've figured myself out, but I think one of the things that I've realized is I'm very obsessive about things. And I like to do things to work just for something. I don't like to have a job, basically. So when you obsess about something, and you know, when we were in ISEC in university, for example, that was something similar, but you don't kind of know exactly what is that feeling that pushes you to do something and to put in the hours. And, you know, what does it take for oneself to work 13, 14 hours a day on a specific problem? And so I think that obsessive nature for me is really important. And I try to see that in other people as well. And it's hard to have a common definition for that, but when you do see that spark in someone else's eyes, especially when you're doing recruitment, it's something so much more valuable than their experience or their background, because that obsessiveness will lead to exponential growth if you give them the right chance and the right freedom.
So you started the BFP network right after university. How did that all come about, and what made you start it, and what is it?
Yeah, so that's a funny story. I can't say it's a very structured one, but my flatmate at university, Amos, I mean, you know, Alex, you know him, he was doing these parties while I was still, you know, when we were still in our final year, and he would, you know, he would work with these promoters in London, and we figured out that actually the club scene in London is, you know, the promoter scene, you get someone in, you get a good reputation, you get someone in the door, and you sell a ticket for £20, and you get to keep £20. You don't have to pay anything to the club. And sometimes if you sell a table, you even get 10-15% of the table. So you have a cost base that is almost zero, and a revenue that you can keep all together. So your gross margins are literally 100%. And but the thing is, with most promoters, they're just very unreliable people. And so we found that, I mean, first it was just for fun, just organizing these parties, and then you sell tickets online on Eventbrite, and you use Facebook ads to get people to buy them. And when you do social media well, you suddenly realize that you can sell a lot of tickets to a lot of parties, and you start to build these brands around with a certain following, and people know that you have a certain party. And then you also build a reputation with clubs that you're professional, which is actually very rare in the club scene, that you're actually showing on time to meetings and replying to emails. So you'll build a reputation, and based off of that reputation, you realize you can make money. And then, so for us, we then started to build more to that brand, to it, more a lifestyle brand for finance professionals. So we would do beyond just kind of these events in clubs. We would then do kind of dedicated smaller scale events for finance professionals. So let's say director level professionals or MD level professionals, let's say whiskey tasting or a whiskey blending session, for example. And so we would work with Chivas, who wanted to promote their whiskey bottles, organize it, you know, at a Michelin star restaurant in London, get a room, get the Michelin restaurant to promote through our network. So everything is around centered, you know, marketing towards finance professionals, because we had a very big reach, relatively big reach. So we had, I think, about 10,000 people kind of in our reach. And so everyone, all these clubs, all these restaurants, all these firms, they wanted to have access and be noticed by these finance professionals who have, you know, spending, discretionary spending power. And that was kind of what we sold to everyone kind of around. And I think the beauty of that business in hindsight is that our costs were so low and the profits were really high. The problem on the downside is that it doesn't really scale. And so, you know, as a first experience for me, you know, full time on a certain venture, it was a really good learning experience. So I think in particular, to what I would do a lot is I would literally just call the email people, and then, you know, the manager of this hotel, I would literally email them, hey, look, you know, do you want to work with us? Give us our members 20% discount of your hotel rates, and we'll promote your hotel. And that is a really useful skill that I still have, because, you know, I can build up a relationship with anyone. I mean, later as you, you know, get to know more people, you start to get introduced, and it's less about the cold outreach, but that cold outreach is still really important. You know, can you sell yourself and what you're doing and build a relationship with someone in a fast way and make people like you and have fun at the same time. So, yeah.
And how did it actually go? I mean, did you find success with this, you know, the revenues and so on?
So, I mean, I think for me, obviously, there was never enough success. So we never got it to the stage, I think, where we wanted it to be. In hindsight, I think we were actually quite successful in terms of building a brand and having some of these events go viral. I remember one particular time we had a Facebook event, this summer party that we promoted on Facebook. It went viral and we sold 350 tickets within 24 hours. That was quite crazy. We had a million hits on Facebook, and there wasn't any science behind it. And so what frustrated me is that there wasn't a formula to actually scale the business. It was kind of more down to good Facebook advertisement, good copy, good images. And so there wasn't really a product per se. The product was the experience. And so you can't really scale that up. And so I didn't feel that it was really doing something wasn't really making an impact. So that always, I think, for me in hindsight, kind of was a bit frustrating for me. And one of the reasons why I always felt I want to do something more with myself. But in hindsight, again, it was a really good experience to have at the time, because in some ways, I hoped I'd enjoyed the journey a bit more, because I was very kind of frustrated. I always wanted more, but I wish I had enjoyed it much more, because it was actually a really good time and a really good experience.
So you were there for a few years. How did you decide to move on and start something else? What was that like?
There wasn't one moment. I think for me, I don't remember exactly how that went. It was more of a process of I personally want to move more into technology. And so I moved into that direction. And I think I decided to work for a couple of months for this technology company, just to get a taste of what it is to be in a VC-backed startup, which I hadn't. With BFP, we all funded it. It was all funded by ourselves and just through revenue. And so it was a gradual process. And I read a couple of books as well, which taught me a lot. I started to learn how to code and just naturally kind of moved into that direction, into doing something else. There were no deliberate choices, let's say, if that makes sense. It was, and I think in hindsight, and I think you see that with other people as well, where you just have a feeling that you want to do something. And as long as you kind of keep pushing into that direction, you'll end up where you want to be, as long as you keep yourself open to new ideas and opportunities. But yeah, for me, at least my journey was that after BFP, I worked, I think, 3 months at this SaaS technology company, which in hindsight was tremendous experience because, you know, with respect to the team there, I learned a lot on how not to do things. That really was for me a big lesson, especially now that I am in a leadership position. I learned about how not to do things, and especially on a personal level. And that was, I can't stress how valuable that experience was. After that, I then went on to work as a sort of a consultant for someone who wanted to build ventures. And so then I almost started another business.
So what took you from there then? I mean, from doing these sort of short-term things, right? 3 months there and consultation and so on, to then your next venture. How did that go about to start?
Well, I think the satisfaction, I just remember now as I'm talking about it, when I was working at that technology company, I think after month two, I started to spend half my time still working on BFP. And I would go for lunch and have meetings. And I thought people didn't notice, but apparently people did notice. Afterwards, they told me, which of course isn't particularly good of me, but I was just very dissatisfied. And you feel you can do more with your life. And I just don't really enjoy I just was very dissatisfied. And so that dissatisfaction gets you to do other things. So I would learn about AngularJS. I would learn about Python. I was learning, reading one of the books that really influenced me was this book from Eric Schmidt on how Google works. And I think that really had an impact to me. One of the things that I picked up there that I didn't really realize in terms of, it's I think in one of the final chapters, he says that when you're young and you're still kind of have the luxury of choosing where you want to go in, choose your industry first, then choose your company, and then choose your job. And I think it's very simple advice, but I think a lot of people don't think in those terms. And so for me, it was really, I wanted to get into technology.
So tell us about PureCell then. What were you trying to build there, and how was it different than, I guess, you know, like the last SaaS company you were at? How did you build it kind of to have a purpose?
Well, partly it was down to, I saw the people that were building that other company. I was like, wait, I can do that as well. And so then it was because I was using Salesforce, and I felt really frustrated by doing some things. And then I thought, you know, what if we build a wrapper on top of this and just talk to the Salesforce API? We can automate so many different things. That was kind of the initial idea. And kind of luckily at the end of that year, I went through a breakup, and then suddenly I had a lot of time on my hands. And so what I did, I moved back into my mother's house in the Netherlands, and I just full on just 14, 15 hours a day, just coding. And the platform itself basically would automate you would do your emails in the platform. You would do your calls in the platform. It had like, you know, some analytics, some basic analytics, like a tracker. It had like a CRM. So everything that Salesforce did, the main stuff, was basically put into PureCell. But then all your calls or all your emails and all of that would happen in the platform. HubSpot now, HubSpot already has this, but back then there were only a few that were actually doing something like that. And so I felt this was something that I could really kind of sell. And in part for me, I just wanted to make it work. And failure itself, I was embracing it. So even if it failed, I knew I would make it work somehow. I don't know, it's a really weird feeling to describe, but you just keep pushing the wall until it just moves, and you just keep going until something happens. And so during that period, I would kind of go to London occasionally to do some, I would use the platform myself as a salesperson and actually reach out to people and ask if they were interested in something like this. And I think I had like 10 people wanted to start paying me money for it after a couple of months. So it was great fun. I really, really enjoyed that period. I got a big beard after it though.
With PureCell, so I think it lasted for 1 year. Why only 1 year? I mean, what happened at that point in time?
Well, so I was introduced to Heiko, who's my partner now at Kraken. So Heiko had been working already on Gracken for about a year and a half when I met him. And we were both in Cambridge at the same time. My housemates were in his course. He was doing a master's in computer science. And we had a couple of beers. And it was just, you know, just another, you know, casual meeting, a couple of beers in Shoreditch. At BrewDog, it was my first time at BrewDog. And we just hit it off really, really well. And it was the first person I met in a long time. Actually, the first person ever, I think, that I resonated with in a certain level that I had never done with before. And so that relationship was really inspiring for me to push forward what I was doing on my own. He at the time, he already had a team. So it was quite inspiring for me to help me push myself forward in a period that was quite tough. You know, you're pushing ahead by yourself. And he was looking for someone to help him push on the business side with Gracken. And so a couple of months after that, I think he asked me if I wanted to consider joining him. And I still remember, I think it was around 1 a.m. in the morning, I was sitting, I was coding, and he sent me a message on Messenger. And yeah, of course, I mean, I kind of expected it because he kind of hinted at it before. And it's difficult because, you know, when you're so obsessed by one problem, and someone asks you to consider another problem, that at least with Gracken, what we're doing is magnitudes bigger than what I was doing on my own. So the decision was very easy to make in hindsight, but at the time, you do feel like you've got this baby you're trying to nurture. But at the same time, there's this, you know, less, I guess, also less about the actual problem you're doing, but also recognizing that by that stage, I had two business partners before. So the one from BFP, and there was a company that I almost started in the middle where I had a fallout with that particular co-founder. And so that feeling of knowing what's a good business partner, that experience was also very, very guided me a lot in my decision, because whatever you're doing eventually boils down to your relationship with that person, because you're going to get very, very close with them. And it's a very unique relationship you have with that person. And I think knowing how to assess that is a very unique skill, because it's almost impossible to develop it other than through experience. And so all those factors to me eventually made me comfortable making this. I think it took me 4 or 5 weeks before kind of saying yes. But I think I knew from the minute he asked, because I had no idea what Gracken was about, by the way, when I joined. I knew somewhat, but yeah.
So what is Gracken? Yeah, might as well share it now. What do they pitch you on? Yeah. What was their vision like? What did they tell you when they convinced you to come over?
I wasn't that interested in the vision per se, because I didn't understand it with a context. It's more about, do you want to go on a journey with someone you want to go on a journey with? Because that's what's most important, because you do it together. And now, but Gracken specifically, so what we do is, now I like to go very high level and I'll go a bit deeper. Now, when you think about computer science as a field and as a science and its role within our human history, one of the most important concepts and ideas that pushes the field forward and as a consequence pushes our humanity and our civilization forward is that the idea of creating abstraction layers within programming languages. If you think about a language like Python, if you do a print statement in Python, you're doing just one line. If you do the same in something lower level, like assembly code, you're writing 50 lines of code. Now, what that means, when you go higher level, you push down certain operations into some lower level system that allow you to think at a higher level and as a consequence, be more productive and solve problems that otherwise you wouldn't be able to solve. At the database level, the last time we actually created a real abstraction layer was back in the 70s when relational databases were invented. And since then, most, if not all, of the innovation we've had in the database space has been around scalability. So scaling horizontally, serving thousands, millions of customers at the same time. And so what we build is really that abstraction layer, because the type of data that we're using for software today is so complex that we require some form of abstraction to push down the complexity into something lower level. So specifically what we build is something that we call knowledge base. And so when we talk about a knowledge base, we talk about a database that works with knowledge instead of data. And what that allows the developer to do, and the developer uses our query language Sprackle to build their software, to work with their data, to query for it, is really allowing them to build very complex software and solve very complex problems in a very simple way. And specifically allows them to build faster, go to market faster, enables products that otherwise couldn't be built, we see companies in the life sciences space, cybersecurity, finance, e-commerce, telecommunication. The use cases are very broad that we see, and
And like you mentioned, it's mostly open source or open source communities. What is your monetization strategy? How do you provide that, you know, revenues?
So we also have an enterprise version of our product. So companies that are going into production, they want to scale up their deployments, they would use our enterprise product, which is called Kraken KGMS. And the open source version is called Kraken Core. And so Kraken Core is always open source, but then our enterprise version, that's a paid software for companies that are deploying serious applications on top of Kraken and need to monetize that.
How's that conversion like? So I guess people start with the open source, and then you get a certain conversion in the funnel to paying customers.
Yeah, that's right. The goal there is to help them succeed developing. So if I'm building a chatbot, let's say, I may go through an evaluation period when I'm going to try different types of databases. You know, that evaluation period may take 1 month. And so in that period, I may look at three different database offers, and I may build three different POCs with each one. And that may include Kraken as well. And if successful, they may choose to build their actual chatbot with Kraken. If they do, they're still in the open source. And as they develop, we try to support them as much as we can, make sure that their development is successful. And as they move into production, we start talking about, you know, what's your licensing strategy? What's your modeling? What's your commercial model? And we try to make the commercials for them work as they deploy into production. And that process, depending on the company, it's kind of out of our hands, you know, can take anywhere from 3 months to 12 months.
Talking about a community, I mean, especially for Kraken as an open source, that's very important, of course. How do you go about starting that? Like, how do you build that community?
You have to care, first of all, and you have to create a feeling, a vision, because people want to be attracted to something higher than themselves. And so we try to be very aspirational in how we talk about what we do, because we generally do believe in what we say. And we generally do believe that using Kraken can do amazing things to your software development. And so we want people to feel that excitement, because we feel it, and everyone that uses Kraken to us is an extension of our team, and we want them to be part of that team. So there is that as the first principle. And then in terms of the implementation, it's really about responding to everyone in the community. If people send me a message, I'll try to respond as soon as possible. People can email me. We do these webinars. People can ask questions on Twitter, on LinkedIn. There's so many places where people can interact with us. And I'm always making sure that everyone has responded to everyone's questions as much as we can, reasonably. And that eventually is noticed, because people, the great thing about that is that it becomes viral, and people speak between each other as developers. People switch jobs. And so you get that reputation within the industry, and that reputation is really hard to build. It's very easy to lose at the same time. So we're extremely, extremely proud to maintain it, and we will do our best to keep it at that level. And of course, at the same time, building a great product that underpins everything, of course.
You talked before about the importance in your life of being kind of obsessed with one problem or being passionate about a certain issue. What keeps you motivated, and what keeps your drive going, you know, after you've been in the product for a longer period of time?
I think there's a lot of different things. I mean, for us right now, it's about really making a huge impact in the world. One of the things that we're extremely passionate about is that enabling software engineering to go to the next level when it comes to working with complex data and solving some of the world's most complex problems. That itself is a guiding lodestar for everyone in the company, because that's ultimately why we built the product. And that vision is interpreted by everyone in a slightly different way. But since there is commonality between that vision, we can converge and work together towards that vision. And I think the privilege for us is that we get to learn about so many different use cases that people are working on, some of which are obviously under NDA. But it's amazing to see someone doing a PhD for the European Space Mission Agency, someone doing with Kraken, someone doing a cyber threat intelligence platform with Kraken, and you know, if Sam or Julian are listening to this, a shout out to them because they've done an amazing job with OpenCTI, tremendous, tremendous work. And other things like building autonomous vehicles, team at TNO, for example, Joris and Willek and Fika and everyone else I'm forgetting there. And helping them build what they're doing is truly a privilege. In it's because we're so many different areas that just being alive is, you know, is a privilege in that sense. And the fact that you have a real kind of hand in changing the direction of something so important is, you know, I think to us, we do feel that we're working on some of the best work of our lives. And you know, time will tell, but it's that that cherishing that is so important. And I think, you know, everyone that we bring in the team, we want to make sure that they have also that feeling. And that's why recruitment is so important to us as well. Yeah. And I mean, the world is an amazing place. I mean, some of the stuff on the technology and R&D side that's being done is incredible. I mean, you know, there's research happening on extending people's lives to live forever, theoretically, the stuff on quantum mechanics. I mean, it's not enough time to do all of that.
Do you often get people who are part of your open source community that want to join the company? What is that?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, we do. We've never hired someone, I think, yet from our community. But yes, there's a couple of days ago, I got someone asking me if he wants to join. So he's going through the process today, right now. And ultimately, the strategy is to have the funnel, first and foremost, to be from the community, because that's those people understand your product much better. So that's absolutely part of the recruitment strategy.
Yeah, I think it's really cool that you get to leverage that community for your own team.
Yeah, yes.
What are some other major learnings that you found from running open sourced communities?
It's really the power of brand and community and how you can outsource, not the right word, but how you can create a set of advocates for something that they also believe in, because there's a stake for them as well, and how you can really kind of get them involved in your team. So we've launched this program called Kraken Warriors, where we're trying to give back to some of our most loyal community members, and give back in the sense when they share some of the stuff about Kraken to others, whether they write an article, or they speak about Kraken in some shape or form, we try and help them as much as we can, whether that's through, you know, in-kind gifts or trying to promote their stuff to other people or making introductions to other people. Really the power of community at a very, very large scale. And the beauty of that is that, and our privilege is that we're in a position that we see all these trends happening in so many different industries, from finance to cyber to autonomous vehicles to e-commerce, that, and I don't think we really realize this on a day-to-day, but we have a very good idea of where the technology industry is as a whole, because normally you only work in one vertical and you don't get a sense of actually what's happening across industries. And all industries are different, by the way. The people you speak to, they have different assumptions and different ways of thinking. And that's where community is so interesting, because you can have that cross-industry impact that otherwise would be really hard to do. And ultimately, you know, if I think commercially and from a business point of view, that creates tremendous value for the business, because even if someone builds the exact same product as you do, they don't have the same brand, they don't have the same community, because that takes time those are relationships with people. So, you know, I like to tell a story. One of our most loyal community members, Mark Kitson, if he's listening to this, a big shout out to him. He's been a great follower of our stuff, and he said such nice things after our conference. We had a first conference actually in February, and he's been a great supporter for us. And I don't know if I should say it because it's a bit embarrassing, but he asked for our signature at the end of the conference, which I was very, very, very embarrassed about. But it's a privilege to be able to help people and people that really believe in what you're doing, not because they think you're nice, not, but because they believe in the technology, because these are very, very smart people.
Yeah, I think I read in that book you mentioned, actually, when how Google works, they say they do default to open, wherever they build the product, they do open source first as the first option.
Yeah.
And I think it's like an interesting approach, because a lot of companies are very restrictive, trying to like, hey, this is our product, and they fail to leverage their own community and their own people using their product. So I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
Oh, very fascinating for sure. So for Kraken, I mean, what is sort of this, like, say 5 years ahead, right? What is sort of the outlook of that for you guys?
Well, our outlook is more like a 20-year vision, to be honest. One of the things that I find really sad, especially about this part of the world in Europe, is that the last time a real category creator company was founded was back in the 70s with SAP. And I think there's so much potential in this part of the world, so much untapped potential, that we should have a category creating company from this part of the world. So we want to be that company. And so to us, building that category means building community. That's why we want the community. That's why we're not going full enterprise. It means having our research centers here, and sure, from an R&D perspective. There's incredible engineering talent from universities, not just Oxford, Cambridge, but also ETH Zurich, for example. And you can really do something here in this part in Europe, because the world is changing. And it sometimes does make me sad to see some companies being snapped up by some of the bigger ones, some companies with incredible technology, but really fail to commercialize and build a business out of it. I don't want to name any names in public, but it really pains me to see, because great technology doesn't just mean a company. And we want to do things differently. So for us, it's really important to build a business, because that means we can actually do what we do best, allows us to grow the open source community. And so when we talk about 5 years, 20 years, it means about building that ecosystem, that Kraken ecosystem. And to us, it doesn't mean just the current product we have. We already have actually a second product that we built for our engineering team that we may or may not release publicly as an enterprise or an open source product. And that's how we think. We're all about developer productivity. We want to make the lives of developers as easy as possible to build the greatest software in the world. And ultimately what that means is our civilization progresses one step forward.
So you've been at Krakenwood for 2 or 3 years now. What is something you wish you would have known when you started that you don't know now? What's some of your big learnings from being on the team?
I think enjoy every single moment of it. Life only happens now, and the journey itself, I mean, it's so cliche, but the journey is a destination, and every single thing you do, even, this conversation, I want to enjoy this conversation with you guys. I'm very appreciative to be that you guys are so interested in the work that we're doing, because for us, this is just life. And enjoy it in the sense that there isn't anything else. Like, life is this. This is life. There isn't anything else. And being so grateful that we have the opportunity to do this, what we do. And so, because I guess I haven't really touched on that, but things have been really, really tough at times with Kraken. I've personally gone through very, very dark periods, psychologically dark periods that, I can't really share with the rest of the team. Only really with Heiko, and of course Heiko also really, psychologically a lot of struggles, and so it is really, really hard, and you grow from that. And I would advise to no one to be an entrepreneur, to be honest. So my advice, don't go into entrepreneurship, because you're fucking crazy to do it. You really are. I mean, there's better ways to make money. Like, there's way more better ways if you want to be rich. Especially if you just do a simple risk analysis. I get very upset at this obsession of entrepreneurs being rock stars these days. I think it's a very unhealthy way of thinking, because if you want the adulation and if you want the riches, again, there's better ways of making a lot of money. But if you really don't have any, if you're really obsessed by it, then great, then that's your path. But and enjoying it, because, and also the dark periods, because those itself, that's also life. And being mindful about things, I think that's really, really important. Yeah.
You mentioned books quite a bit in this podcast just now as well as before. If you had to pick, let's say, top three books now for you, what would these be?
So if number one, a book I just read, or actually in December, from Lincoln. So Team of Rivals, incredible book. Team of Rivals, the political genius of Abraham Lincoln. and his ability to form a team of rivals, and really his love and his passion. I got emotional at the end of the book when they murdered him. I recommend that one. Another book that really, really impacted me emotionally was a book called The Score Settles Itself. His name is Bill Walsh. Bill Walsh. It's a well-known book in terms of leadership. It's a very honest and personal book on the struggles of leadership, and from Bill Walsh's perspective in particular. The third book that I would recommend, again, these are all recent books because they're the recent part of my memory, but one book that I really enjoyed reading was called Lifespan by David Sinclair, which just was released last year. It's a summary of the research of the past two decades in longevity research. So it's, why do we age? You know, his thesis is that aging should be considered a disease. And actually, if we understand aging, we could actually not just reverse aging, but actually we could never die. Because according to the science so far, and of course it's still a hypothesis, aging is just a process of loss of information in our epigenome. And our epigenome is what reads our genes. So our genes never change, but the way the genes are expressed does change. And so you get cells being expressed wrongly, and that leads to failure of organs. That leads us to lose our color of our hair. I'm getting gray hair myself. So I find it incredibly interesting. It does raise a lot of very fundamentally challenging questions about our society if people live longer. And I actually think that's a bigger issue than the science itself. But of course, if there's a pandemic, then we should fix that first before getting to the other research. But yeah, those three books I think I found really interesting. But those are the ones I've read in the past 6 months.
Cool. Yeah, I think we're nearing the end here. Any quote you want to share with us today?
The quote that I share a lot is a quote by Alfred North Whitehead, author of Principia Mathematica. And he said that our civilization advances when we extend the number of operations we can do without having to think about them. And fundamentally, that's really down to what I was talking about before about creating abstraction layers. But it's not just about computer science. It's really about how do we do things at a higher level. And ultimately, that leads us to advance our own civilization. And that's as simple as automating your calendars to automating your programming languages.
Inspiring as always. Thanks a lot, Thomas, for coming on.
Thank you, guys.
How can our listeners connect with you online?
So they can find me on Twitter. Twitter, my handle is TASabat, TASABAT. Or they can also join our Discord server at gracken.ai/Discord. And they can also find me on LinkedIn. Those are the key platforms, I would say. Send me a message and I'll do my best to respond.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Awesome.
Thanks so much for listening today and for making it to the end of the episode. I hope you learned something. Our theme song is The Vendetta by Stefan Kartenberg. If you want to connect with us or send in your guest recommendations, drop us a line at lunch.learn@gmail.com or connect with Alex or myself on LinkedIn. Otherwise, have a great week and we'll see you next time on Launch and Learn.